This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Well, the night sky for August 2009. I'm going to start with something I don't usually do. I want to say something about the moon, which obviously is not specifically relevant to this month. But I expect some of you saw that NASA have released some photographs taken by what's called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO. That actually got to the moon on June the 23rd, and it's gradually reducing its orbit until it's about 30 kilometers above the surface. Now, it's not quite there yet. It's about 60 or so kilometers, but already it's taken some photographs of some of the Apollo landing sites. Now, if you go to the Night Sky website, just put Night Sky into Google on our Jodrell Bank website, I've actually used two of those images as my image of the month, those of Apollo 11 and also of Apollo 14, which is rather nice because you can actually see the disturbance of the ground as the astronauts walk from the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, across the surface to where they located the Apollo Lunar Science Package called ALSEP. You can actually see that as well. So I'm hoping these photographs might finally lay to rest what we might call the moon hoax. Now, there are two other things to say. Earlier this year, a group of British astronomers decided to make what they call a world record lunar image. They got together and using 11 and 14 inch optical telescopes, they made a total of about 280 separate images of small parts of the surface at high resolution. And then these were composited together to give an 87.4 megapixel image. That's the largest image ever made of the moon from the ground. It has a resolution of about half an arc second, and that's basically about 1 kilometer on the lunar surface. And the images are stunning. I've shown an overall picture and also a detail of the region around Plato and the Alpine Valley, and it really is absolutely superb. There is a link to the website where you can actually scroll around the moon's surface and zoom in, but also you can actually go to a page where you can order or download a file or order a print, and most of the money will actually go to Sir Patrick Moore's charity. So do please follow those links. It's a wonderful image, well worth looking at. And finally, this month too, Google have actually put a Google Moon into the Google Earth system. And that allows you to scroll around. And the best bit, I think, is that they've actually got some television sequences in high definition taken by a Japanese spacecraft as it flew over the lunar surface. And those really are superb too. They're shown as little blue squares on the image. If you click on them, you can actually go to the YouTube site where these are available. So do have a look at some of those. It's really quite nice. And I think interest in the moon is sort of rising again. A little bit more in the highlights. Okay. Well, let's first start with the stars. Leo is pretty much setting in the glare of the sun, but it is still just possible in the first couple of weeks to see Saturn and then Mercury, which actually be very close to Regulus on one of the nights during the month. So it's still there low in the sky. Higher up to the left is the constellation of Bootes with its bright star Arcturus. And just to the left of that, a little arc of stars called Corona Borealis. That's the Northern Crown. And I apologize that last month I said it was the Northern Star. That's just a brain not linked to mouth, I'm afraid. The Northern Crown. Moving up towards the south, you will see the constellation of Hercules. And it has four stars making up what's called the Keystone. Look up the right-hand side of the Keystone and you can actually see M13, a lovely globular cluster, a fuzzy glow in binoculars, a fuzzy blob in binoculars. But if you have a telescope, it can look absolutely stunning, particularly if the telescope is, say, 8 or more inches in diameter. Below that is Ophiuchus, which has got almost nothing of any note, I'm afraid. Below Ophiuchus is, in fact, Scorpius, with its lovely red star Antares. Sadly, from the northern part of the UK, it's barely above the horizon. We don't really see it very well. But if you go perhaps to the south coast, or preferably go on a summer holiday south to the Canaries or somewhere in southern Europe, you'll see it much, much better. And also, to the left, you'll see the constellation of Sagittarius. The main stars make up the shape of a teapot. In fact, one of our listeners has actually sent an email saying, you know, why did I call it the teapot? It used to be known as the Archer. And that is, of course, its real name, Sagittarius the Archer. But the main stars do really make a rather nice representation of a teapot with a handle and a spout. And so if you look at it on a star chart, in fact, you'll see, I think, that the teapot is quite a nice name. It's a bit like we actually have a name for the brightest stars in Ursa Major. That's the Great Bear. That's the constellation. But we actually call that group of stars in the UK the Plough, and the Americans call it the Big Dipper, after the ladle that was used by the farmer's wife, perhaps still does, to ladle out soup to the farm workers at lunchtime. So that's why we call it the teapot. It just looks a bit like one. And if you actually think about where the liquid might be coming out of the teapot, out of the spout, with binoculars, you might see a little fuzzy glow, which is a rather lovely open cluster called Messier 7. And above the teapot, a little glowing region called the Lagoon Nebula. So it's a very nice area to look at, but sadly, you do really need to go rather south to see it. Over to the east in the sky, you'll see a rather lovely region that we see throughout middle of the summer and well into the autumn. It has three major constellations, Cygnus, Lyra, and Aquila, the eagle. Cygnus, the swan, has a bright star called Deneb up at its left. It's the tail of the swan. Lyra has a bright star, Vega, and the brightest star in Aquila is called Altair. They make up what is called the summer triangle, I think a name given by Sir Patrick Moore. And as I've said before, if with binoculars you move up from Altair towards Vega, you cross a slightly darker part of the Milky Way, assume you can see the Milky Way, and against that darker part you can see a little asterism called Brocky's Cluster, or the coat hanger, because it looks like an upside-down coat hanger. There's some lovely objects to view with the telescope in this region, and again, if you go to the night sky page, I have details about some of the interesting constellations that are best visible this month, so have a go at that. So, what about the planets? Not a bad month, in fact. Let's start with Jupiter. It's now lying in Capricornus, and it's actually rising just after sunset, and in the middle of the month, on August the 14th, it's actually at opposition, which means it's roughly due south around midnight. It's opposite the sun. So when the sun's hiding behind the back of the Earth, Jupiter's high in the sky. Except, sadly, this year it's not high in the sky. It's lying close to the bottom of the ecliptic, the lowest part of the ecliptic. It never reaches more than about 25 degrees above the horizon. And that means atmospheric refraction can actually upset its image if you're looking at it with a telescope. I tend to use either a green filter, and you can try different colours, just to get rid of some of the colour effects, the fringing you get. And with a big telescope, you could use a very narrow band filter. There's actually a green filter called Oxygen 3. It's a line, spectral line of oxygen. And that means you're looking at it in monochromatic light, so the refraction effects in the atmosphere go away. But because that filter cuts out most of the light, you do need a fairly big telescope for that to work. But a green filter will work with most telescopes to give you a rather cleaner image than you'd actually get just looking at it in all colours. The magnitude stays at about minus 2.8 the whole month. That's because as it's closest to us, the distance isn't actually changing very much during the month. It's actually quite big now, about 48 arc seconds across, I think, and that means that on a clear, steady, calm night, you should be able to see quite a lot of detail on the surface. Interestingly, just recently, people have noticed a black scar on the surface. That could have been the impact of a small bit of comet or asteroid. You might remember, perhaps about 15 years ago, comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was captured by Jupiter. It broke up due to the tidal forces of Jupiter, and over a course of about a week, the individual little lumps of comet impacted on the surface, giving scars, some of which were twice as big as the size of the Earth, and they were easily visible in a small telescope. I think that made people aware of what might happen should a comet actually hit the Earth. The effects could be quite disastrous if it's a big one. But don't worry about that. It doesn't happen very often. Well, I mentioned Leo and Saturn. It will be seen just low down above the western horizon in the twilight. You might even need binoculars. Its magnitude is plus 1.1, which is not particularly bright. And that's because the rings are very close to edge on. In fact, at the beginning of August, they're just at 1.9 degrees from the line of sight. Now, on the 9th of August, the rings of Saturn are actually edge on to the Sun. Now, that means we certainly can't see them in reflected light. What you will see, perhaps, is a little dark line across the centre of Saturn, partly caused as a sort of a silhouette of the rings, and partly the shadow of the rings on the surface. So that's actually quite an interesting night to have a look for it. After that, in fact, the other side of the rings are illuminated, not the side we see. So although, sadly, Saturn really will be lost in the mire, the glare of the Sun, after about the middle of August, you know, it might be interesting to have a look. Mercury. Again, that can be seen, probably needing the help of binoculars, low in the west, again in bright sunlight. It dims from magnitude minus 0.4, which is not too bad, to plus 0.4 during the month. On the 2nd of August, it's just 0.6 degrees above the star Regulus. So that might be quite nice to look at. And on the 26th, it actually is 3 degrees from Saturn. But I rather doubt whether you'll actually manage to see both planets by then, because they really be very low to the horizon in the glare of the Sun. What about Mars? Well, it's becoming more prominent in the pre-dawn sky. It's rising just after midnight and will be seen fairly high up in the east before dawn. The current magnitude is about +1. Okay, it's getting nearer to us, or perhaps we should say we're getting closer to it, because we're moving around the Sun sort of on the inside track somewhat faster. And the angular size increases from 5.3 to 5.8 arc seconds. So under really good seeing conditions, when the atmosphere is very steady, you might start beginning to see some of the prominent features on the surface, particularly Syrtis Major, a dark V-shape form, and also perhaps a hint of the polar caps. Now, later on during the year, as the Earth comes between the Sun and Mars, it'll be closest to us and will have its maximum size, so giving us the best view. However, because Mars has a fairly elliptical orbit, the separation between the Earth and Mars when it's at its closest varies quite substantially. A few years ago, it was about as close as it ever gets, and the angular size was about 25 arc seconds. But at the moment, that angular size at maximum is getting less. It's only going to be something like 16 or 17 arc seconds at best later in the year. More of that to come in the following months. Well, finally, Venus. It's now moving further away from us towards the far side of the Sun. And that means that more of it is illuminated. It's now a waxing gibbous disk, about 14 arc seconds in size at the beginning of the month. But of course, as it's going away quite quickly, that drops to 12.6 arc seconds before the beginning of September. And the magnitude is dropping from -4 to -3.9. That's not much. And something I've said before, an interesting fact about Venus is that it stays pretty constant at about magnitude -4, even though its distance from us changes quite substantially. The angular size varies by about a factor of 5. And the reason is that when it's nearest to us, the phase is thinnest, but the actual reflecting area that we see in angular size stays about the same, no matter where it is. So 4.4 down to about 4 is the sort of the range of magnitudes we get for Venus. Well, finally, what about some highlights of the month? Well, August is the month when we hope to see the Perseid meteor shower. Basically, it's fairly long-lived. You could see it any time from about the 10th to the 15th of August, and it's best probably from 11 o'clock onwards, as Perseus, that's where the radiant is, that's why it's called the Perseids, that rises up in the east. Now, this year, it's not going to be totally brilliant because, sadly, the moon is going to be rising at about the same time, and its glare will obscure the fainter meteors. In fact, there'll be less of the moon, and it will rise later towards the end of that period. So the 14th and even the 15th might well be best. The Perseid meteors are particles normally smaller than a grain of sand that were released as a comet called Swift-Tuttle passes the sun. So anyway, 'tis worth having a look, but let's hope the moon doesn't cause too much of a problem. Now, the first week or so of August is a nice time to look at Jupiter with a small telescope. We normally see it with four satellites. Well, if you look around the end of July, beginning of August, it will appear to have five. Now, of course, it hasn't got an extra one, but there's a star. It's called 45 Capricorni, which is only just fainter than Callisto, one of the Galilean satellites. And it's sort of an interloper, so it will really look as though it's actually got five satellites. And on August the 3rd, Jupiter will occult it. That means it will pass in front. That will start at about 11:52, just before midnight, British summer time, and carry on for about a couple of hours, and then it will reappear again. And I do hope it's clear, and you might have a chance to see that, the night, really the midnight of August the 3rd, 4th. Sadly, I'm just going to be arriving in Rio for the International Astronomical Union, and I rather doubt I'll be able to see it. Well, I've already mentioned that in early August, on the 9th particularly, Saturn's rings disappear. Certainly it might be fun to have a look at that any time during the first couple of weeks of August when Saturn is still visible. You'll almost certainly need to have a location where the western horizon is really very low. I can go up onto a little hill near Alderley and look out over the Cheshire Plain. I thought that was a spot that I'd found myself. But when I went there one night, because there's going to be a nice conjunction of three planets visible low in the west, I found three other astronomers there. So obviously this was a good spot. But you do need somewhere where you've got a good low western horizon to see it. I've mentioned the moon before in this report, but we do have a sort of event on the morning of August the 6th, so the night of August the 5th, just after midnight on the night of the 5th, 6th. Now, then it's full moon, and that's, of course, when the moon sometimes passes into the shadow of the Earth and we get a lunar eclipse. And they're wonderful when it's total, but even when you have a partial eclipse, when at least part of the moon goes into the full shadow of the Earth, it can be really rather lovely. Now, that's not happening, I'm afraid, on the morning of the 6th, but there's what's called a penumbral eclipse. It means that part of the moon, the lower third, will pass into part of the Earth's shadow, not into totality at all. The lower third might then appear somewhat washed out, the contrast will go, and obviously a little bit less bright. So it might be worth having a look for. So you might get a sort of a flatter, dull grey tone. Anyway, that's quite a few things to look at during August, and as the nights get a bit longer, you haven't got to stay up quite so late to see them. I do wish you well. Okay, well, we try and say something for those in the southern hemisphere. And let's say what you might see looking north during August, perhaps 8 p.m. in mid-August. Well, you have a lovely view of the Milky Way at the present time. It arcs overhead with the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpius high overhead. I've talked about those before. They are, of course, upside down for you, so the spout isn't really looking in the right way. But nevertheless, you have a beautiful view, and I do wish I could be down there with you to see it. Below Sagittarius, we have Aquila the Eagle, and down lower in the northeast, you've got Lyra the Lyre and some of the stars of Cygnus the Swan. I could mention that just over to the right, if you follow downwards from Aquila, it's a rather sweet little constellation called Delphinus the Dolphin, a sort of little narrow pentangle of stars making out the head and the tail. It's actually sort of upside down from you. From us, it looks as though it might be leaping out of the sea. But that's a beautiful area to look at. And left, just in the north, fairly low down, you've got Hercules. Then you've got Corona Borealis, Perhaps it's naughty we call it the Northern Crown when you see it in the south as well, but it is in the north. And then you've got Bootes with the bright star Arcturus. So that's quite a nice view as well. Looking south, of course, you've got the Milky Way dropping down to the southwest. There's a beautiful region I've talked about quite a bit earlier in the year where you've got the constellations of Centaurus, Crux, Musca, and Vela and Carina, a very rich part of the Milky Way. And you could perhaps go back to some of the earlier podcasts this year when I talk about some of the things you can see there. One thing I could mention, that fairly low in the sky is Vela, and there's quite a big cross there. It's called the False Cross, much, much bigger than the Southern Cross, Crux, which is higher in the sky, but often picked out, and sometimes people think, oh, I've seen the Southern Cross. Well, in fact, the big one is called the False Cross. South, almost due south, you have the large Magellanic Cloud. Up to the left of that is the small Magellanic Cloud. As I've said before, just above the small Magellanic Cloud, you might pick a little fuzzy blob. That's a wonderful globular cluster called 47 Tucani. Now, the large Magellanic Cloud, to its lower right, has a rather rich region. It's called the Tarantula Nebula, and sometimes 30 Doradus. There's a star cluster there, and one of the largest regions of star formation that we know of. Because many stars are born there, some will be quite massive, and they'll die. And in 1987, we had a supernova, 1987A, that was seen in February. And that has actually been one of the ways we've been able to get a more accurate distance to the large Magellanic Cloud. We now think it's about 157,000 light years away. That's partly being done because the light from the supernova, as it left, spread through space at the speed of light, and sometime later, about 230 days, illuminated a ring of dust that had been ejected by the star sometime earlier. Well, if you know the diameter of that ring, and that was measured by the Hubble Space Telescope, you know the time it takes to illuminate it from when the supernova exploded, then in fact you can actually calculate the distance. And that's one of the ways we've now got a better idea of the distance of a large Magellanic Cloud. And that's a very useful stepping stone in terms of distance to the more distant galaxies. It forms part of what's sometimes called the cosmic distance ladder scale, the scale that we use to gradually work our way out further into the universe to find distances of remote galaxies. So it's quite an important little galaxy. It's sometimes called an irregular galaxy, sometimes a barred spiral. It has a bit of a bar across it, and it is in fact the fourth largest galaxy in our local group. The Andromeda galaxy is the largest. Our own Milky Way galaxy comes second. Then there is M33, a face-on spiral galaxy with a small nucleus. And then four, the large Magellanic Cloud. So again, the skies are very rich in the south. I'm hoping, in fact, to come to New Zealand beginning of July next year to lead a group of people on an affinity cruise in the south of South Island amongst the fjords. And if it's clear at nights, we'll have a lovely look at the sky. So that's something for me to look forward to next year.